Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Ours is a world of a few major languages and many others spoken by smaller groups of people in places far from capitals of commerce. Now, these lesser-known tongues have a remarkable value of their own. They are the lifeblood of cultures that are themselves original responses to the common problems of humanity. So each of these languages has something crucial to say to us. And we're all diminished when one of them vanishes or is even threatened with extinction. Indeed, we have a stake in their preservation. My guest is John Zeiker, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. John, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
John, with your help, we're going to meet a very interesting people today, the people called the Dolgan, who live in Siberia. There's something like 8,000 of them. 4,000 of them speak their native tongue, Dolgan, and I want to get a sense of what that means and why that's important. And this, of course, raises the question, what is the essential importance of preserving this language? I mean, why is this effort that you're undertaking as a scholar, and obviously encouraging others to undertake, of use to us? I mean, what is important about preserving Dolgan?
Well, it seems that the ability to speak the native language, at least partially, is related to these people's identity and pride about being who they are. The 4,000 people that speak Dolgan are sort of divided both geographically and in terms of age. Uh-huh. And it seems to be there's a process of where younger people are not learning the native language, and this is kind of due to education, it's due to settlement into villages, and it's due to proximity to urban centers.
Right.
So people living closer to urban centers tend not to speak the native language so much, whereas the people that are farther away speak it a little bit more.
Tell us a bit about the Dolgans, John, so we can get sort of a, through our imagination perhaps, a kind of a visual image of this people. I mean, in terms of their ethnicity, from what family do they descend, and what kind of essential culture, at least briefly, have they developed?
Okay, the Dolgan are basically a Turkic-speaking people. Again, the language is a mixture between Evenk and Yakut, so the structure of the language is like Yakut, but there are a lot of Evenk words in it. As related to their ancestry of being Evenks, they were reindeer herders, whereas most Yakuts traditionally were cattle breeders in southern Siberia. When the Dolgans moved north and started to live with the Evenks, they adopted reindeer herding, so their dress is a little bit closer to the Evenk style of dress. Mm-hmm. And they rode reindeer on saddles.
Right.
And they also had sleighs. They lived in covered sleighs during the winter.
These are nomadic people?
They were semi-nomadic. Yeah, they had home ranges, very large home ranges. They would migrate with their herds several hundred kilometers every year.
I don't want to violate the discipline and the rigor of a scholar who's looked at this, but you know, the image that came to my mind, tell me if I'm way off base on this, you made me think of the little bit I know about Lapp culture.
Yes.
Is there a similarity?
There is a similarity. Uh-huh. Basically, the reindeer herding cultures of Eurasia seem to have a common origin back into the Bronze Age, several thousand years ago. And there was a dispersal of this culture north and west and east, actually.
You know, John Zeiker, I think just from what you've and I have been able to talk about briefly, there's a lot of curiosity about Dolgan as a language and what it may sound like.
Okay.
So with your permission, I propose we might listen to a bit and you tell us what we're listening to and what it means. I know that you've pre-selected a bit of a conversation, if you will, or at least some colloquial, perhaps Dolgan being used. So let's listen to a bit of that and you can tell me what the meaning of it is.
All right.
Olo tolayaktarı, olo kimya agatim bırakı gari evi gari, ehelleri gari.
I feel like I'm eavesdropping. Tell me what was going on there, John Biker.
Well, this is a part of a series of interviews I conducted with Aksenia Maximovna Bezrukich, a 93-year-old Dolgan woman who was the last of the Edyan clan.
My goodness.
And their people traditionally lived in the area around the Norilsk Lakes, which currently has been turned into a very large industrial center in the region, a nickel mining and processing zone. She basically did a series of interviews, and we talked about her life history. And in this clip, we heard her daughter, Albina, and one of my best friends up in the Taimyr region, Ilya, and we were trying to talk about, you know, what subjects we were going to discuss in the life history.
Now, she at 93 is a native Dolgan speaker, of course,
yes,
to the exclusion of other languages? Or
she spoke a few words of Russian,
uh-huh,
but Dolgan was her primary language.
Would that be true of Albina, her daughter?
Albina, she spoke Dolgan as a primary language, and Russian, she also speaks Russian very fluently. So her you wouldn't really be able to tell that,
right,
she didn't speak Russian.
Now, does Albina have children?
Albina does not have children.
Or nieces or nephews?
She has, yes, she has adopted.
Adopted. Well, that younger generation of her relatives, what would they speak, or what do they speak?
They generally speak Russian.
Aha. Yeah. You see, I'm getting at John Zeiger. So,
yes, uh-huh, they generally speak Russian, and they maybe can understand. It depends how old they are. The children that are in the generation that's in their 20s and 30s right now, they tend to be able to understand some Dolgan, but they rarely speak it.
I see.
As far as telling stories or full conversations, I never observe that.
So with this remarkable woman who's a tribal elder, you've essentially preserved oral history.
Yes.
Have you not?
History of mm-hmm, her people.
Right.
And we talked about subjects such as her marriage. And she was one of the last people that was married in the traditional Dolgan way, which involved a long period of negotiation between her parents and the groom's parents. There was a lot of wealth exchanged. There was a big party and a lot of preparations. Her parents prepared for her an entire argish, which is a reindeer caravan,
mm-hmm,
that was decorated and beaded, and new teepees were built for her and her family.
Just struck me, that would be the early part of the last century, wouldn't it?
It was right around she got married right after the Communist Revolution.
So 1718.
It was before the exact years. It's not quite known, she didn't know. But it was before the advent of Soviet power in the region, which was in 1930.
That's extraordinary. Now, in addition to the Dolgan, John Zeiger, in the Taimyr region, is that mm-hmm, correct? Well, Siberia, where you're doing your scholarship, it continues, I know. There are a handful of other groups as well, and
right,
having talked with you, I know that they're not necessarily related to the Dolgan, are they? They may be separate groups.
Yes.
In the same way we've had a little introduction, thanks to you, to the Dolgan language and sound, I propose we look at another group, just
okay,
by nature of contrast, both in terms of who they are culturally and what this particular excerpt is like, because this is some music.
Yes.
From a group called the Naganasan.
Naganasan.
Naganasan. Let's listen to it.
Okay.
Quite different.
Very different, yes. The Naganasan currently live alongside the Dolgan in three permanent villages in the central Taimyr. And the community where I did my research is one of those communities. So they're both Dolgan and Naganasan people in this community. The Naganasan, their language is very different from the Dolgan. It's part of the Samoyedic family of languages, which includes Nenets and Enets. Mm-hmm. And they are also reindeer herding peoples that live farther west in the Russian north. The Samoyedic language family is theoretically related to other Uralic languages, which would include the Finno-Ugric languages, which we mentioned before.
It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. The particular piece that we heard at least a brief excerpt from had, of course, a lot of drum in it. What was it? I mean, what were they doing? What were they trying to say musically?
The two women that were in this sound clip are part of the Nomtuso, which is a Naganasan clan that is fairly well known for its shamanic practices. And what they were doing here was basically an incantation to invite the spirits into the house so that they could foretell my future.
Wow.
Yes.
That was related directly to you, that
piece? They did this seance and another seance before I left, basically to wish me a good path in the future. But this earlier seance was telling a few things about foretelling my future and also trying to guess a few things about my past, which were fairly accurate.
Isn't that amazing?
Very interesting.
I'm thrilled we picked that particular piece. I didn't know it had that personal connection to you. So, but this is a people that obviously lives very close touch to their spiritual roots. I mean, their theology is a part of their lives.
Right.
Is that right?
Actually, both the Dolgan and Naganasan are that way. And there are many prescriptions and taboos and interesting ideas about how they relate to their surroundings. And it has a lot to do with their resource conservation, actually.
But you know, this also teaches me, John, or at least suggests to me, that if they lose the language, a lot's going to flow in the train of that. I mean, because if they're doing things like connecting to the spirit world, and the language, they're not going to do that in Russian. And if they're doing that in such a way that, you know, the future and the past are revealed and sort of, you know, conveyed, it's culturally right at the core, isn't it? I mean, you just don't trade that off.
Right.
And keep stuff.
They're, you know, everything from the names of places and how to get around in the tundra to the spirits and information about what plants you can eat and what plants are useful for other purposes is all conveyed in the language. And when that goes, a lot of this information is going to be lost.
You know, and I don't let me get carried away or get overly romanticized about this, but because of that, and actually I'm very moved by this personal example here, this tie to you. Because, you know, we're very concerned, and rightly so, about disappearing species biologically in the world. It's about time we got concerned about that. But the ultimate effect of this development, I mean, if the language disappears here, is you're going to have essentially disappearing peoples.
Right.
I mean, they'll become something else. I mean, physically, I mean, they may be go on, but they won't be the same.
Right. They're not going to disappear, but they're going to be marginalized minorities, or they're going to, you know, be in the. They're not going to have the same opportunities that other people are going to have. They are experiencing a sort of an isolation right now with the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Right, exactly.
And because, well, when Soviet power came to the area, they incorporated them into the socialist economy. Now that the socialist economy is breaking apart, they're losing a lot of their traditions because of this incorporation into the larger economy. They are now living in a situation that's not really traditional. They're living in a permanent village, but they don't have the institutional support that they had from the Soviet government. So they're kind of getting it from both ends.
We can't leave this question without me asking you what you have done. I mean, I know you've collected all these tapes, but lest anyone think you're simply exploiting and sort of gathering for your own purpose, let's make it clear that you yourself have done things in terms of helping to archive.
Right. That's correct. All the tapes and videos that I've taken in the Taimyr region, I've made copies and given them back to the people that are in them, and also provided them to local media, which serves as an archive in the Taimyr for these.
I'm glad we make that point, John, because I think that is an important one to make. Let me take a moment from our conversation, John Zeiker, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is John Zeiger, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. John, I want to turn to matters of economics and politics now, which you alluded to briefly earlier, because this is a people, as that marvelous history of that 93-year-old woman suggests, who've gone through some major transitions in the century, from the Tsarist era to the socialist era, which was transition dramatic enough, but now there's one, even as we speak, underway, is there not?
Yes.
And this is the market economy. How is that affecting the Dolgans?
It's affecting them in a number of ways. On a basic level, I've recently looked at some census information that I gathered up there, and they've had a really significant drop in fertility since 1993. It's about half of what it was before 1993. 1993 is kind of a cutoff because the reforms, the market economy reforms, really hit the region only in about 1993. They lagged a little bit from the rest of Russia. And in 1993, the state enterprises that were located in each of these permanent settlements that the Soviets constructed, they stopped paying the native hunters and fishermen for the products that they had been encouraging these people to produce for the last 40 years.
Well, you know, these kinds of things, though, they're happening all over Russia, aren't they? I mean,
they are.
I mean, these inefficiencies and the pensions that don't work, the payments that aren't delivered, the delays and that kind of thing.
I mean, people that are, that do receive some kind of social welfare payments, such as a pension or invalid payments, they get them, but they've gone down in value so much that it's it's very little money. The economic research I've done shows that their purchasing power has gone down by an order of magnitude in the 1990s.
Am I right in thinking these are people who are no longer reindeer hunting?
Well, no, they are reindeer hunting.
They are reindeer hunting.
The Dolgan and Naganasan in the community where I did most of my research, Ustavam, lost their domestic reindeer in the 1970s as a result of this settlement into a permanent village. At the same time, the state enterprise encouraged them to conduct hunting of caribou, trapping of Arctic fox mainly, and fishing of various species of whitefish and trout. These products were very highly prized in industrial towns in the region. So they basically became industrial workers for these large state-organized hunting organizations. In 1993, this whole system collapsed, and most of the people in these communities now have become unemployed. As a result of that, the fertility seems to have dropped. And another really, how should I say,
disturbing,
thank you. another disturbing process seems to be an increase in violent mortality. The violent mortality
murder.
Well, murder included also suicide, drownings, freezings. This is the tundra, and people wander off into the tundra drunk, and if they fall asleep outside, they can freeze to death.
This
it's increased. It's doubled since the early 1990s.
This is people in crisis. I mean, that's not
pretty
overstating
much. I don't want to be alarmist, and I've received some letters recently from this community, and they tell me, and I tell them that I'm worried about them, you know, and they write back saying, oh, don't worry about us, we're doing all right. But this year they did not have a very good caribou hunting season. They only got 180 caribou for the whole community, whereas previous years they've killed up to about 2,000. So their food supply is pretty low, and people are being forced to go off and, you know, trap small game.
We're at a very critical point in the conversation because this kind of you know, extraordinarily depressing scenario suggests to me that the Dolgans, being obviously intelligent and clever people, must be developing what I would call survival strategies. And I'm going to ask you about them because I think you've done some creative thinking on this. And correct me at any point I get any of this wrong, but I have a sense that Russians who were looking at this process at its inception predicted that the Dolgans, everything would work, first of all, and the Dolgans would sort of integrate themselves more and more into the scheme of things writ large. And, for example, they have this claiming process whereby they could make lay claim to land portions and become a part of this, quote, market economy system. But that ain't working. Right. And I think what, and here's the part where you, you know, do take me to task. But I think what you're saying is, in light of all these failures, there may be a stronger attraction to traditional culture or some revitalization of it?
Some movement back to it, yes. Uh-huh. In 1992, partially as a result of the lobbying efforts of the All-Russian Association of Indigenous Peoples, which is currently, the acronym is currently RIPON, they succeeded in getting the President of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, to issue a decree on immediate measures for protecting the economic activity and living places of the small numbering peoples of the Russian North. And this decree was, there was a lot of optimism surrounding this decree in 1992 and 1993 when I visited the Taimyr for the first time. Mm-hmm. And what the idea was that indigenous families and clans would be able to take large hunting territories and claim them as their family property. It's a communal, traditional resource base. And with this traditional resource base, they would then preserve their traditional economy, but in the atmosphere of, you know, democracy and a free market. So the idea was that they would produce some products that would be used in the larger economy, and that they would pretty much take over the function of the state enterprises. But what appears to have happened is that the claiming of these lands has not really been associated with any kind of economic benefit.
I see.
So at first, 92 through 94, there were a number of families and clans that claimed these lands, and then after 94, it dropped off significantly.
There's no incentive. I mean, if it's not providing you any economic benefit, why do it?
Right. And in order to you know, practice subsistence hunting, which is what they're doing mainly right now to live, they don't need to have formal land claims.
Right.
Actually, a lot of land around Ust-Tavam has reverted to what I would call communal use. Mm-hmm. So lands that were in the 1960s through 1980s assigned to particular hunters or brigades of hunters are now available for use to everyone in the community for subsistence hunting.
Right.
And this is sort of a revitalization of traditional patterns of land use, and sharing is another really important thing.
I think we should, at this point, just to give people a sense of the dimensions, the overall dimensions of physically of what we're talking about here, is that the Ust-Tavam, which you've mentioned, is a city, is that right, town?
It's a settlement. 600 people.
600 people. At the heart of Dolgan region.
And that, yeah.
It's the Taimyr.
It's right in the middle of the
right
Taimyr.
Right in the Taimyr. Which in turn, and here's I think the, is enormously large, is it not? I mean, this is eight, and I memorize this, and I'm determined to use it, 850 square kilometers, or twice the size of California.
850,000.
850,000 square kilometers, of course. So this is an enormously large
It's an enormous territory.
With a small number of people in it.
The largest portion of the population is non-indigenous and is concentrated in two cities. One, Norilsk, which is the industrial town, which is actually not officially part of the Taimyr region. It's part of the larger territory that the Taimyr region is administratively subject to, the Krasnoyarsky Krai. Mm-hmm. And then Dudinka, the capital of the Taimyr region, has about 35,000 people. The rest of the people in the Taimyr region, about another 15,000, are spread across 17 settlements and two regional centers, one at the confluence of the Yenisei River and the Gulf of the Yenisei in the western part of the Taimyr, and Khatanga, which is the county capital of Khatanga district in the east part
of it. Is this flatland, lowland,
highland? Most of it is lowland. The southern part of the Taimyr is the basically the foothills of the central Siberian plateau. Right. And then across the center of the Taimyr region, in the heart of traditional Naganasan territory, is the Buranga Mountains, which basically runs across the Taimyr region.
Well, John Zeiker, you and I have spent, for me, certainly a very rewarding period of time talking about this region, which is enormous in terms of physical dimension, small the number of people who are directly living there, but of vast importance in terms of culture and linguistic heritage. And I guess that leads me to my concluding question, because you clearly have invested a lot of your time and I think your heart in this work. And I'd love for
you,
if you would sort of, in that same vein, just think about this. What is the importance, John Zeiger, of this kind of work, this kind of activity that you're undertaking to us beyond that territory, in other countries, throughout the world? I mean, what's at stake?
I would say that the diversity of our species is at stake. Once a species becomes over-specialized, it seems that it is subject to a lot more detrimental effects of environmental changes, let's say. And that's kind of a very large statement, but what I mean is that it's basically, I feel that it's a sign of a healthy type of system when you have a lot of diversity. The fact that there seems to be a homogenization of cultures occurring across the world, besides the fact that it makes things more boring, we lose a lot of knowledge about how to live on the earth. We seem to be really intensifying in one type of strategy, but there are a lot of different strategies available. Or historically, there were a lot of different kinds of strategies. And the Dolgan and the Naganasan represent a type of strategy, an Arctic lifestyle with, they survived without really market economies. They utilize their resources in a very rational and prudent way. They don't overhunt. Mm-hmm. They have a really good feel for these kind of things. And to the extent that this is disappearing, I think it's not forebode well for the future.
Well, you've made me a believer. I mean, I, from this conversation, fully understand, I think, that if we lose cultures like this, we all lose as members of a human family. These various solutions to what are ultimately common problems of life. John
yes.
Zeiger, thank you for being
thank you very much,
with us, and I hope to see you back here again soon.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was John Zeiger, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.